This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. On this special episode of Fully Vested, Jason and Graham discuss and stand in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. This show was recorded on June 7th. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
Graham.
Hey, Jason, how are you?
Well, you know, it's that's a complicated question to answer these days.
Yeah, I feel you.
Like, personally, I'm okay. I'm safe. I have an apartment. More than what a lot of folks can say. I'm employed. I have health insurance, all that good stuff. But you know, like, there's a lot of, as we record, it is June 7th, 2020. And for the better part of the last, seven or eight days. Yeah. Like,
at least.
Yeah. The country has been in a state of serious strife over a very weighty issue, which is police brutality and the systematic oppression of Black people and other people of color. And all of this was kicked off by the what's now been ruled a homicide by medical examiners on two occasions, the homicide of George Floyd, under the knee of George Floyd is a Black man who was living in Minneapolis, who was killed by a white police officer by having somebody, you know, the white police officer knelt on his neck until George Floyd passed away in the street in the middle of the broad daylight. And I don't know if you saw the video. I'd be surprised if you haven't seen at least clips.
I've seen some of the clips, yeah, which are terrible to say the least.
Yeah, I watched the whole thing, and it's really horrifying. And so, you know, like, here's the thing, like, this show, Fully Vested, when we originally launched the show, it began as a very, perhaps as an exceptionally lighthearted or at least sort of like, you know, poking fun at and talking seriously, but also taking an opportunity to laugh and you know, make jokes at the expense of, you know, incredibly successful, at least from a financial standpoint, like venture capital folks and like startup founders. But
the industry in which I work and on which you report.
I used to be a reporter and now I'm a researcher.
And that we both really love, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we have a really deep, even when we have lighthearted jabs, you know, at the industry, we both really do care about technology and the VC space as a whole, and think that there's a lot of good that comes in the world holistically from the industry that we love so much.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the time.
Well, there are exceptions.
And not saying that the VC industry specifically is responsible for this, but obviously we're going to, you know, dig into what is a really terrible set of situations and you know, what has obviously kind of become, you know, societal systemic approach to things. But we're going to take a look at that from the lens of the industry that we love and care about, and you know, see how it approaches or should approach diversity and inclusion moving forward.
Yeah, And right. And before we get to discussing in some detail stuff that people are protesting right now, you know, I'll start by saying that, like, and Graham, I'm sure you'll back me up on this, that the VC and startup industry does not necessarily have a shining history of being particularly diverse or being particularly inclusive.
I wish that it did, and I wish I could, you know, quote a bunch of facts to refute that. And there are probably several shining examples of VC-backed, you know, diverse founders. But yeah, in general, that is unfortunately for the most part true.
Yeah.
And I think that applies, and to go kind of one step further in the negative side of things, I think that applies to both people who work in the VC industry, and I think that applies to the funding that is received by companies.
Yeah.
You know, and I cannot change that I am a white man, at least not easily in today's world, but I certainly am a big proponent of, or try to be a big proponent in every way I can, of diversity and inclusion of people of all kinds of difference. I certainly believe Black lives matter. But yeah, it's definitely an industry that does not, as you pointed out, have a kind of shining track record of supporting founders of diverse backgrounds.
I think that's it's a fair way to put it. Before we get into the stuff, such as it is, the actual subject matter of today's episode, I suppose we should probably introduce ourselves, and I can start.
Sure.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley. I am one of your two co-hosts here on Fully Vested. When I'm not doing this, I am a researcher at a company called Golden, which you can find at golden.com. It is a San Francisco-based startup seeking to build the canonical source for knowledge. And I do a lot of research into various sort of emerging technologies and the startups and financial folks who are operating within them. And then I also do some volunteer work for open source software foundation, helping them with some startup outreach stuff. So, Graham, who are you?
My name is Graham Peck. I am a venture partner with Cultivation Capital. Cultivation is a St. Louis-based VC that invests in food and ag science, life sciences companies, and software and IT. And I'm specifically a member of our software and IT fund. And I am part of our team that sits in our office in Chicago. In addition to that, I also help companies of all shapes and sizes, large and small, and a lot of dev shops to build and recruit their development teams by partnering with offshore developers in Eastern Europe. And the company I help grow is called Brightgrove.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. So, little bit of a content warning. We're going to be discussing, not in any sort of extremely explicit detail, but we will be stating some of the top level facts from a couple of recent cases of Black people being killed at the hands of either currently serving like active duty police. Active duty, this is the militarization of the police issue, right? You know, active duty mm-hmm. is probably not the right term to use, technically speaking, in the context of police, although given the fact that they've basically become little paramilitary units, you know, running the streets, so to speak, I guess that might be it. But anyways, deaths of some Black people at the hands of currently, you know, active officers and the... an involved one that involved a person who was formerly a law enforcement officer, but who had their bad stripped from them. So as we speak today, there are protests that continue going on around the country, catalyzed by the death of George Floyd, but which also harken back to plenty of other incidents from slightly more distant history, but from more recent history, referring to the deaths of Breonna Taylor, and then also Ahmaud Arbery. And my apologies in advance if I mispronounced his name. I think it's important for us to talk about what has happened to these three people. I will try to make it short and quick, because there's no enough people have dwelt on this subject area, and there's not much more that I'm personally able to add, even though I was formerly a news reporter, not covering obviously this sort of stuff, but other people have done a better job of this than me.
And what I think we also want to say is that, while we've talked about political consequences, with one or two exceptions, always how they specifically impact startup and technology investing. We've talked about things like Donald Trump's potential impeachment when that was potential. We talked about PPP loans, which were a SBA program that was certainly highly politicized and in some ways continues to be. I think we want to say that this show is not a political show.
Yeah.
We are, for the most part, trying to look at how our community, being technology and other venture funding kind of communities, how we have historically and should, and most importantly, should be moving forward in light of these three specific instances and holistically kind of the situation going on around them.
Yeah.
So it's important to note that while we're going to talk about these three instances, this is not a pivot into us becoming any type of a political show,
right.
Although we'll talk about politics from time to time,
but,
and Jason and I do personally offline all the time.
Yes.
But we're not, pivoting this into a political discussion. And of course, these are three incredible tragedies out of a very, very long list of tragedies. We're going to, after going through some details of them, we're going to talk about, how they impact or what the future impact should be on our specific niche or industry moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment of what we're trying to do here. Mostly, I wanted us to talk about this because right now feels like we're living through a world historic event. Like, I forget. I think it might have been, what was his first name? Vladimir Lenin? I think so. Yeah. Vlad.
Yes.
Yeah. Wasn't it? And I am also, for the record, not a Leninist, but I think this is a fantastic quote. Butchering it a little. There's some weeks where, like, decades happen, or like there's some weeks where years happen and some years where weeks. Anyways, like there's a whole lot of history that has been packed into just the past like week and a half. And I figured it's important for us to talk about it because what is happening today as we record in the beginning of June 2020 should, maybe not necessarily will, but definitely ought to reverberate, into the future. And I wanted to sort of capture the headspace now. So,
yeah, I think something that I've alluded to in the past one to, I think actually two episodes that we've published has also been that I really want us to publish some good news
and we'll
in
get
the
to
times
that.
Of coronavirus. And I promise you, We were preparing for an episode with exactly that. We're going to feature several companies that both are benefiting small businesses that have been impacted directly by the current times and that have at least announced their fundraising during COVID times. And I'm really excited about that. And I'm really excited about the future of where the world can go. And as Jason and I were preparing for that episode, we did not feel that we could be, and I won't speak for you, but I'm an optimist, a pretty extreme optimist, actually. But we did not feel that we could do any justice to an episode about optimism in times of global pandemic unless we first addressed the elephant in the room. And we feel that the elephant in the room is the current societal state spurred on by at least these three tragedies.
Yeah. So without further ado, again, I just wanted to throw up a little content warning. We're going to be talking about officer-involved deaths of three Black people. Which if you read the news at all, which if you listen to the show, there's a decent chance you do. You probably would have already heard some of these details, but they are disturbing to some people. And I just wanted to throw it out there. If this does affect you in a negative way and you don't want to hear about that, but you want to sort of get to our response to sort of what's all going on and then discussing what members of the Black people in the VC community are thinking about this. I guess just skip ahead a few minutes because I'll try to make this quick. So Graham,
we'll put that time code in the show notes. We'll put that in the notes. So if you've gotten this thus far and you don't want to hear any additional gory and unfortunately true details, then we'll give you a time code to skip to.
All right. Well, so. Where to start? Okay, so let's start most recently. For roughly 9 minutes on Memorial Day 2020, a white police officer named Derek Chauvin knelt on George Floyd's neck in Minneapolis. George Floyd was Black, and Floyd died on the scene. His death was ruled a homicide by the medical examiner. There was two autopsies of his body. Both ruled that it was a homicide. A bystander's cell phone video went viral on Facebook and other social media sites and catalyzed the protests that we're seeing today. Floyd was 46 years old and left behind five children. Chauvin and attending officers. Chauvin was charged with second degree murder, and officers who were on the scene have been given not murder charges, but other criminal charges as well. And that was after a great deal of pressure from protesters in Minneapolis and elsewhere.
And those other officers specifically were charged for not stopping, charged with those crimes for observing but not stopping what was happening
right
to George Floyd.
Okay, so next is next, sort of going back in the past, is just after midnight on March 13th, 2020, Louisville, Kentucky police officers used a battering ram in a no-knock raid on Breonna Taylor's apartment. So just for context, a no-knock raid gives police officers or other law enforcement officers responding to a scene. Obviously, they don't have to knock, ergo the name no-knock raid. But even when they reach the entrance of a structure and enter, they are not technically obligated to disclose that they are police. There was some flavor of, so this was what I will personally characterize as breaking into this woman's apartment, was done in conjunction with an investigation of two men suspected to have been selling drugs. They were allegedly selling drugs out of a house 10 miles away from Breonna Taylor's apartment. Breonna Taylor was in her apartment with another man. There was some flavor of altercation, verbal altercation. The gentleman that Breonna Taylor was with apparently had fired one shot because, again, not knowing who was entering the entering their apartment. Miss Taylor was shot 8 times and she died at her home at 26 years old. So again, we've now had May going to March, going back to February 23rd. A father and son duo of sorts, named Gregory and Travis McMichael, both white, allegedly participated in the killing of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery, a black man, while Arbery was jogging through Glynn County, Georgia. Travis fatally shot Arbery with a shotgun and rammed Arbery with his truck, shouting racial epithets. A man named William Bryan Jr. recorded the killing on a cell phone video in a, what I will just characterize personally editorializing here as a weird plot twist. It was revealed actually quite recently relative to the time of recording that Gregory McMichael, the father, the older guy, himself a former law enforcement officer, was the person who initially released the video of the murder. Gregory, Travis, and the accomplice, Mr. William Bryan Jr., have been charged with murder and other crimes in conjunction with the death of Ahmaud Arbery. These three people, were taken out in the prime of their life by, in two cases, angry white, police officers or police officer adjacent people with guns. In one case, a angry white guy with a knee on the guy's neck. This is stuff that has no doubt been happening a lot for decades, many decades, probably back to the very creation of the quote unquote modern police system as it exists today, which in turn took a lot of early hints and inspiration from much more racist institutions that existed in the pre-Civil War South and then the post-Civil War South. And it's become clear that to more people, myself included, I'm, for the record, I'm white, Graham's white. I grew up relatively, privileged in a, quote unquote, nice suburb outside of Chicago. I was never really exposed to much violence of any variety, much less state-sponsored violence against people of my own race. I'm not the first, there's a bunch of other people that have said this already, but like the proliferation of cell phones and social networks and all the rest has really, and seriously, the work of hundreds, if not thousands, of individual activists, both actively marching on the streets today and doing incredibly important work in the background. Because of all of this, all of the ways that we can all become aware of what's happening in the world, even folks like me who grew up in a relatively tight, secure little bubble, have come to realize the incredible structural level unfairness that exists in the criminal justice system today. And it happens, unfortunately, at the you know, the business end of a gun, or, you know, the business end of a knee, of a lot of white people, and a lot of black people end up suffering for it. And it's very sad to me, and I'm sure to you, and I'm sure to everybody else.
Yeah, definitely.
So
we would be, I said this briefly earlier, but I think we would be remiss if we did not reiterate that, you know, Black Lives Matter. And of course, that's the official stance of us as individuals.
Yep.
And this show, you know, that represents essentially only some of our personal positions.
Well, we're pretty transparent on this show about what we believe or not believe. But like, you know, there's this, I remember a year, two, 3 years ago, in the before times, you know, when time, you know, before the pandemic, before time sort of moved as a sort of like a slow oozing paste, right? Back when you could actually distinguish between individual months and stuff. I remember around the time that Black Lives Matter as a sort of organization but
it's probably, you know, both an organization and movement.
Sure. Yes. Fair enough. I remember what was it, Graham? A few years ago? When Black Lives Matter was getting started, and I remember there being a great deal of, I personally felt a little bit of tension, right? I'm like, hey, I'm a white guy. I'm not racist, you know, like my life matters, everybody's life matters or whatever. And
that's definitely what I've, you know, what I remember thinking then.
Yeah.
I think that there's a little bit of a different approach now, or a different belief now. You know, and I think you maybe have a better kind of feel of the pulse of why that is. But I guess, you know, it was interesting. I was talking with a friend recently, actually in a more public setting, and I think you might have been there too. But this friend is a white VC, and his response was, you know, I'm not exactly sure what's different. And I think, you know, we could talk about a lot of the things that are different now. And I hope it actually is genuinely different. But his comment was, I'm not sure what's different, but I feel like it is this time. And I hope that's true.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of different, I'm not speaking for anybody except for my own personal, you know, opinions and observations here. But I think that there's a couple of different things in motion. Let me do a real quick real-time Google. When did Black Lives Matter start?
You know, one of the other things, and this is a little bit off of kind of the very serious kind of note.
Sure.
That we're on, and not to detract from that or get back to a truly lighthearted spirit.
Okay.
That most of our shows are recorded. But I guess from a new technology enablement standpoint, what all of this also makes me think is, shame on any police force that's not having all of their officers wear body cams right now.
Oh, totally.
And it's incredible to me that a large city like Minneapolis doesn't require that. And I'm certain that they're not alone. And by the way, apparently Minneapolis in particular may have several, you know, similarly racist situations. Again, you know, these three circumstances that we're talking about are three absolutely terrible circumstances, but and I wish that was where it stopped, but it certainly
Didn't stop there.
I'm sure that that's not the end of it. These are just the most recent three that have drawn the most attention. And I believe the head of the Minneapolis Police Department is, in fact, black, and head of the Chicago Police Department. I believe the gentleman recently retired, but was black. And I believe the new head of the Chicago Police Department, the new police chief or whatever the, you know,
Robert Tuttle superintendent, I think, maybe.
Maybe the official title in Chicago, I believe, is black. But it's incredible to just see that, you know, there's these instances of, you know, racism running that rampantly. And, you know, again, not to get into too many more specifics about either what, you know, technology could do to stop it or anything else about the specific instance. But I think also in the case of George Floyd, believe that officer had something like 17 complaints prior in his career of potential use of excessive force.
Yeah, well,
I don't know what's normal in a police career, and I don't know how old that gentleman. Well, zero would certainly be the hope. But I don't know how old that gentleman is. But boy, 17 seems like
a lot
enough to certainly have some questions.
All right. So real time Googling has yielded. I just needed to find the year. Cause everything sort of before the Trump administration sort of feels at some arbitrary point in the past, and everything after the start of the Trump administration feels like, oh yeah, I mean, it could have been last week, could have been 3 years ago. So that actually is relevant. I'll bring it up. So Black Lives Matter was founded in July of 2013 in response to the acquittal of George Zimmerman, who killed, Trayvon Martin. And you know, as for why this feels like it might be a little bit different now, I am obviously not qualified to speak on issue, like seriously on any issues of like racial politics or whatever, but just being like a citizen of the United States and being just even just tangentially aware of like, you know, political stuff, which I've largely tuned out just for my own sanity and like, you know, otherwise there'd be literally nothing else I pay attention to. We live in a profoundly different time than when, you know, Black Lives Matter started. And I think chief among them is the fact that right today, as we speak, the president of the United States, there's been plenty of like racist presidents before, but like most presidential racism has been, you know, at least in the latter half of like the 20th century. And I don't know of any, you know, explicit instances of racism in the 21st century, really up until Donald Trump became president of the United States. But like we have a overtly racist president in a public way. And moreover, recently, a president who has opted to use authoritarian tactics to quell and threaten protesters in a way that was characterized to me by a person whom I work with who is based in a country with a arguably fascist regime. He said, "Holy shit, you guys are fascist now." And I was like, yep.
not letting the current administration at all off the hook for what you just said. I think what all of this, you know, kind of stems from is many, many years, decades, probably generations of policies that allowed the proliferation of systemic racism.
Yeah, no, that's the phrase.
Maybe, and I don't think while you certainly could give names to individuals who have been guilty of that, I've certainly seen a lot of information that a lot of governmental policies, mandatory minimums on prison sentences, things like that, have come to exist under administrations of both major parties.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that we are, if anyone is to blame, we are societally all to blame. Yeah, for this, right? And the thing that is incredibly beautiful and equally terrible when things go wrong about our form of government, which I am the biggest believer I know in, is we serve, not Donald Trump, but in fact, we as American citizens serve in the highest office. And Donald Trump serves us, or that is at least the way it is designed to work.
Yeah.
And to abstract it from that individual, who's incredibly polarizing, of course, the president of the United States is the figurehead elected by a relatively complex and maybe needlessly complex system, but elected by the citizens of the United States. And that form of government and the other locally, at the city, maybe county and state levels, and the other five, the 535 other federally elected officials, are supposed to be watching out for us, and watching out for George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. Again, apologies if I got any of those names mispronounced, and all of our form of government has created a situation that allowed these and many other terrible situations to happen.
I think, but again, to the reason why this time might be different. It also bears mentioning, we stated this earlier, but this is all still happening in a pandemic where people have been locked in their, basically, not exactly locked in their houses in the style of like a Wuhan style lockdown where everybody was basically quite literally stuck in their houses. But a good big portion of the United States has been sheltered in place or under a stay at home order for the last 3 months. And a lot more people are out of work. And more people are in increasingly desperate times. And that all leads to the sort of, those are the basic ingredients, hearkening back to like political science 101. Those are a lot of the basic ingredients for a serious political revolution.
I feel like we're on like a political and economic, our whole society is on a political and economic hair trigger.
Yeah, for sure.
And it certainly didn't take, much to proverbially pull that trigger.
Yeah. So, sorry, I got off on a tangent. Way back when all this stuff was, back when Black Lives Matter was becoming a thing. I didn't necessarily appreciate the antagonism against the phrase all lives matter in the way that I do now. And the way that I understand that now has been mostly through looking at protest signs and listening to interviews with protesters and actually attending a, not being an active participant because I am exposed to people interpersonally who are immunocompromised or otherwise in very delicate health, and I didn't want to catch anything and give it to them. But you know, I went to a protest last weekend on Sunday, took some pictures, and you know, like the general consensus that I've come to understand is that all lives can't matter until Black Lives Matter, right? Until the discount rate, until there is no discount rate on Black lives or livelihoods in the way that there exists today. That, yeah, intrinsically speaking, we are all and should be treated as equal, but true equality can never be actually achieved until the unequal among us are brought up to a level of true equality and equity. So, yeah.
And that feels unequal in some way to say at first, or maybe to hear at first. But mm-hmm. then as you really think about that, of course that makes sense, I think.
Yeah.
And you could probably substitute any different group in for the word black. Any group that is in any way, oppressed is a fine word. Seen negatively by our society as a whole, and say blank lives matter.
Yeah, I mean, and it's especially powerful when you introduce the idea of, you know, of like intersectionality, right? Like, it is possible to be part of many different minorities or oppressed groups. And so, you know, yes, Black lives matter. Black trans women's lives matter. Black trans men's lives matter. You know, like, there's a lot, you know, Black queer lives matter. You know, there's lots of different ways there's a lot of different ways to cut it, but you know, it really comes down to the idea of, you know, we can't be equal until, and it's not a matter of bringing down people of privilege, at least according to my own personal politics. It's about figuring out ways to raise everybody up to that level of privilege that you know, or a flavor of it, at least not being overtly threatened by the police or being worried that you're going to be killed if you get pulled over for going 5 miles over the speed limit or whatever, you know, on a day-to-day basis. That is a tremendous privilege that I've personally enjoyed. I have never seen a police officer and said, oh, hey, there's a non-zero chance that that person could kill me.
Yeah, I also benefit from that, even in close contact.
So
yeah, you know, I've read most of the owner's manual left to us a long time ago by our forefathers, and I don't think any level of anything is guaranteed. But life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I think the words "the pursuit of" are incredibly important in that phrase. But I certainly have a problem with it anytime our society systemically gets in the way of anyone's potential pursuit of their own level of happiness or greatness or anything like that.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's kind of hard to like pursue happiness if you're worried that, you know, you're going to have some, like skinny, angry white dude kneel on your neck.
right. Not if to all laugh, you're seeking but, is to be able to breathe.
Yeah. So, I think we should talk a little bit about just a couple of things that folks who are, so again, I'm not a venture investor, hope to be one day, not currently, but people who are venture investors, people who run companies, can do to support the broader social movement that we're witnessing right now, but also to directly support and stand in solidarity with their employees and community members who are also in turn standing in solidarity with the protests. So I'll start. For one, if you or your company or your investment firm, you know, has the means, consider donating to one of the many organizations supporting racial justice and police and prison reform. You can support a you can support protesters and others who are kept in jail before trial by donating to one of several really excellent community bail funds or bail bond funds, because it gets more people out of jail as they await trial. No, at least in, again, my own personal opinion, Jason speaking here, no person should be stuck in jail just because they can't afford to pay bond, except for like extreme, very extreme circumstances. If you're wanted on like triple murder and you have like a, you know, $5 million bond, like, yeah, maybe you should stay there. But
for the most part, those people aren't offered bond if they don't
exactly
deserve it.
Exactly.
If they're deemed to be an extreme risk to themselves or the community at large, they're usually not let out or given any amount of bond.
Yeah. So, you know, another thing to consider is, you know, however your company can, you know, try to find ways to support employees who participate in protests and the broader movement for racial justice and to end police brutality. It, you know, at least in my personal opinion, Graham, I'm sure you share similar sentiments that this can and perhaps should include matching employee donations if your company has the means. Because I know that a lot of companies, especially after, I mean, like seed and series A stage companies don't necessarily do a lot of like employee matching of like, or like employer matching of employee donations to charities or whatever, for good reason. There's not a lot of money to go around. Everybody's focused on building a product and a business. But
right, and probably not what investor funds should be going to, which are mostly what are backing businesses at those stages, often if they're venture backed and at that stage.
Yeah, but like if you're if you're a Series B stage company or Series C stage company, and at least in my opinion, even if all of your cash on hand is just from investors and none has ever come from customers, even a gesture that might a token amount of money saying, hey, we will match donations up to a total of, you know, $5,000 or $10,000, you know, at the end of the day, not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. It's a 1 month salary for a decent software engineer. You know, like that's probably the least that your company could do in these times.
You know, one of the other things that you know, I think is in our notes as we prepared for this, and of course we'll share our notes.
For sure.
You know, it's also no longer enough to simply not be racist. Someone has to, you know, actively be anti-racist. That's something that I think is really complex to understand and think about. As someone who, I certainly want everyone to feel welcome around me. And I believe the First Amendment, again, going back to the, you know, handbook of this country given to us quite a while ago. I think there's a big reason the First Amendment is the First Amendment, and I think it should be interpreted almost as broadly as it possibly could be, which cuts both ways, even on this issue. But as someone who I don't think I'm racist,
everybody's a little bit racist. It's the old Avenue Q, the puppet musical line from like 15 years ago. Everybody's a little bit racist. But sorry,
what does it mean to be actively not racist or actively anti-racist? And this is kind of gaining a lot of attention lately.
Yeah. So I don't know for myself personally, but I can spot racial behavior. I can spot behavior in white people that I know, in etc., wherein people might make, I'll just start with something that seems pretty basic, but bears mentioning regardless. A lot of humor carries with it, some humor carries with it, racial undertones. In the same way that a lot of, let's just say, a lot of like movies from the 1970s and 1980s didn't really age well because many of them have as a, if not central plot point, then a relevant plot point, the idea of something not great happening to a woman while she was drunk. Right. In the same way that we can say today that those things are not, first off, unacceptable then, definitely unacceptable now. And we can actively shun, that sort of, or at least reject the notion that that sort of behavior is something that really can be found humorous. I think that, and this is not like saying, politically correct police, be the PC police here. No pun intended on the police, I guess. But there's a certain class of jokes that like people shouldn't make anymore unless they're part of the group that they are making fun of. So there's that. There's identifying institutions and organizations and structures that exist today that perpetuate the status quo, which is systematic subjugation of Black people, and being an activist voter, if not a activist protester or, person in the street, to say that those things aren't right, and that the world that we want to live in, if we want it to be inclusive, which if we're all going to actually walk the walk rather than just talk the talk, we want it, it should be, then we need to make votes. The only real source of power that we have as citizens from an official capacity, to vote for the things that we want to see in the world, even if that means, especially if that means, disrupting the status quo in a way that for somebody like myself, a relatively privileged white person, might find to be like, is that good for me? Maybe not, but it's good for the whole. And like those are the sorts of things, because like if I lose out on, 5% of my whatever, on 5% of something or 10% of something, but somebody can increase their quality of life by 75%. To me, that's a fair trade-off. And so that might mean, I would pay more personally, I would pay more taxes to that so that we have better education systems. I would be willing to, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, like, I'm trying to, I don't have specific policy suggestions for what it means to be anti-racist. Other people do. And I will be happy to collate some of those links to at least some of the more mainstream thinking on that. But at least from my perspective, it just means, like, you know, really standing up to any sort of ingrained institution that helps to maintain this very dissatisfactory status quo.
My only fear or pushback is that that can be a slippery slope. Not that any of this is okay, but 5% at a time, it can get expensive. But again, obviously, you know,
it's been expensive for Black people this whole time.
I'm certain that it is, and refer to my prior comments defending everyone's ability to freely and safely pursue their own happiness, and I defer to that first and foremost.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree. Again, refer to other prior comments. I'm a big believer that, you know, political reform needs to be a part of this. I'm not certain that politics only solves this. I'm not sure what else does. While a lot of these things derive from the 537 federally elected and all of the locally elected folks that are a part of our government, I think it has to be broader than that. We need business leaders, and a lot of business leaders are stepping up. I'm not faulting them, but we need a society where look, everyone is different, and I would be lying if I didn't say that. I'm unique in a whole bunch of my own ways.
Sure.
But we, of course, need a society that looks at all of these people based on their merits rather than, you know, any potential discriminatory or potentially discriminatory class.
Yeah, merits are kind of hard to talk about, though, when you're talking about a class of people, not in the sense of socioeconomic status, although that is certainly a part of what we're talking about when we're talking about this particular class, but also, you know, a group of people that has really never been given the chance to excel to the same extent that the group certainly that I belong to, and Graham, I believe that you belong to, has. And so what I would say is I don't feel comfortable, and I'm not saying this is what you're saying, but I would not feel comfortable saying that, like, you need to, people who are in the, you know, disadvantaged groups just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, because like for one, metaphorically speaking, a lot of these folks don't have boots. They've never had the opportunity to get boots. And two, you know, like, and I can say this as somebody who's been sort of like, I mean, as a kid, I was like bullied a bunch, and that really sucked. And I'm happy to, I'll admit that fine on it, you know, here out on air. But like when I became part of quote unquote an in-group, I never really felt welcome until I was in turn welcomed. Right. Even though I became part of a somewhat more insidery group, I never felt as though I wasn't in, you know, the most nominal sense, it part of an in-group, until somebody really welcomed me in. And so, you know, it's this idea of like, you know, people will not feel welcome at your table if you tell them to bring their own chair. If you already have a seat, you know, you should make space and find folks and invite them in, even if they're not necessarily part of the group, you know, the stereotype that you have grown accustomed to reaching out to and including as part of your in-group.
That's something in particular that I think is difficult as a VC community, regardless of race or factor like that. And something that I don't think that the VC community holistically has done that well.
Because it's, I understand the tension here. Because on the one hand, you know, it's nominally speaking an investor's fiduciary obligation to give, you know, to invest in the assets that are most likely to return the biggest result, right? Or the best financial result.
Unless for any reason you're not planning on raising your next fund. That's certainly
sure.
True.
Yeah, so I understand, you know, why, you know, and I mean, this is true of a lot of...
You kind of can't quantify some of the double or triple bottom line stuff. Like you can, but it's hard to quantify that if the first bottom line is just return on investment, just pure ROI.
Right.
If it's not there, the second or third bottom line, unless you have incredibly patient, incredibly forgiving, or incredibly wealthy investors, probably matters much less.
But it's also true that even though it's a smaller sample set, women entrepreneurs generate better multiples on average than male entrepreneurs.
Correct.
And I would venture a guess, no pun intended, that that also would extend to founders of color, because the argument that I've heard regarding women entrepreneurs, and also for the record, founders of color includes women of color who are founders. But in general, women have been given less money deal for deal than men have. And accordingly, they've had to build businesses. They've had to build companies that are sound businesses from the get-go. And I am willing to believe, and anecdotal evidence, you know, that I've seen bears this out, that founders of color who also receive a disproportionately small percentage of the total venture capital invested per year may also, and the numbers may show this as there's a larger sample set that develops, that those founders too produce better returns than the more privileged founders, because again, you have to build, if you're a underrepresented person who is largely undervalued, you know, you need to be a better business person from the start, as opposed to just being very good at raising money.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense, and that's,
I mean, and
both
that's just like the
good and bad, yeah, right?
I mean, that's
good for them in some ways,
yeah.
But that obviously makes the road. I mean, the road through the road to venture funding is difficult for almost anyone,
for sure, 100%,
regardless of track record, regardless of past successes, anything like that. But it's probably that much more challenging for diverse founders. So what are, and again, we'll include this in the show notes,
yeah, yeah.
But at least some of the resources that we've been able to combine, but
sure.
What are some of the things that you're aware of, or that we're aware of, that the VC community is doing as a whole to try from our small slice of the pie, but try to help with all of this.
I want to gloss over one thing, and then I want to end on a good quote from a statement made by an all black VC firm called Harlem Capital.
Awesome.
Great. Okay. So first thing I want.
Our favorite whipping boy on this show did something right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a drop of water in the ocean for them, but
yeah.
You know, hey,
so
SoftBank of all people put together $100 million fund, earmarked specifically for companies founded and or led by people of color.
Yeah. In other words, Graham, they have allocated to an entire fund a fraction of their allocation to certain individual rounds that they have invested in. So I'm taking this to be a very nice gesture on behalf of SoftBank, but given the fact that they have invested tens of billions of dollars in, let's just say, some eccentric and occasionally problematic characters, that $100 million is a decent but woefully insufficient start, given Masayoshi San's ability to manifest capital out of seemingly not exactly nowhere, but to manifest capital to invest in startups. I think that $100 million thing is a token gesture, and it's the absolute very least that firm could have done.
Certainly a good start. And again, I started my comments by, congratulating them. All of that being said, I think that this is one of the common, big numbers problems. Most people, for almost everyone, save just a handful of folks on the planet, $100 million is a lot of money.
It is. But
if you compare that to, for example, the $100 billion of SoftBank Vision Fund 1, or if they raise it, the $110 billion targeted in the raise of SoftBank Vision Fund 2, then we're talking about less than 1/10 of one penny per dollar raised.
Yeah.
So if you actually were to lay that out, we are talking about, less than one penny for every 1,000 laying on the table.
Yeah.
Depending on which fund. And that would be compared to each fund, one that they have raised and one that they're, we assume, struggling but trying to raise.
And this is not to say that SoftBank has never invested in a person of color owned or led or founded company. They've invested in many companies that are founded and led by women. But damn, dude, if you have all that money, throw it at folks who really need it. And speaking of what feels like a token gesture to some, but I think it's very important to clarify, I want to quickly shift to talking about Andreessen Horowitz, many partners of which have announced its Talent X Opportunity Fund, so TXO Fund, which consists of $2.2 million donated by A16Z Partners. There was a little bit of a blow up about this on VC Twitter when it was announced this past week, as we record, that this fund was coming about, because there was a certain contingent of people were like, well, it's, $2.2 million. If you're Andreessen Horowitz, it's Trump change. And you know what? In many ways, you're right. But you also have to remember that this particular fund is not being raised from outside limited partners. This is money that Andreessen Horowitz partners are taking out of their own personal savings. Yeah, I mean savings. It wouldn't be their investment portfolio because it's all being donated. And any returns that come from the fund are reinvested in the fund and in turn reinvested in more companies founded by Black founders. And so it's a donor advised fund. And, you know, like it hopefully will, I mean, as you know, venture capital is a very, very long game in terms of generating any kind of return. But, you know, with any luck and, you know, hopefully, you know, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, one or more of the founders that they invest in hits a good exit. And this donor advised fund has, you know, 3x the money to invest in the next batch. And hopefully that continues to sort of grow and accumulate snowball like over time. And so I think that this donor advised fund model is a very interesting one to help address that chicken and egg problem that a lot of you know, Black founders and other underrepresented founders have faced, which is how the hell do you get money? The answer is raise money to fund these, you know, this particular group of folks. Should also be noted, Andreessen Horowitz has been very active in the philanthropy, philanthropy and fundraising space, helping the Black and African American community. In 2019, they announced their cultural leadership fund, which was raised from, at least my understanding, it was raised from all Black LPs, many of whom are in the entertainment and athletics industry. And, you know, they're investing in other Black and other underrepresented founders, you know, with the whole goal of getting more African-Americans into technology. And then I should also just disclose, really important, Andreessen Horowitz is an investor in my employer, and a Andreessen Horowitz partner sits on my employer's board. My mention and our mention of these efforts by Andreessen Horowitz is not connected with their association with my employer. Just figured I should bring that out in case anybody wants to accuse me of being a shill.
Very important.
Very important. So, Graham, I wanted to conclude with this really great quote from the folks at Harlem Capital, which is a relatively recently launched New York-based all-Black venture capital firm. And they released a statement last week. And I just wanted to read it in full, and then we can respond, and then we can end a show that's gone long, but for good reason. So here we go. Here's the an excerpt from their statement. And this also gets back to the whole idea of being like anti-racist and stuff, but let me continue. While the protests are striking, we encourage people to focus on the root cause of these events, which are racism, injustice, and oppression. Words can be meaningful, but actions speak louder. Actions like texting a Black colleague, educating yourself and your network, speaking up publicly, voting in elections, and voting with your dollars are the start of meaningful change. As a firm with a mission focused on increasing access for minorities and women, we continue to focus on economic empowerment and using our energy to make the world a more equitable place. And I really think that the core message of that, which is that actions speak louder than words, and that, you know, you and me, Graham, chatting here on a podcast is all well and good, but, you know, what, and anybody here listening to it, you know, is all well and good. Thanks so much for listening, Graham. Thanks so much for talking to me. But things will not change, you know, until people change the way that they act.
You know, it's interesting that you kind of bring that up. My parents, when I was growing up, told me so many times that I always swore if I would ever get a tattoo, it would be that phrase, "Actions speak louder than words," tattooed across my forehead. because they said it that many times. And I think that that's a great way to conclude, with that phrase and that reference. And I guess I only can hope that this podcast and that the industry that you report on or do data analysis on and that I work in, I only hope that we can be a continued, maybe with a resurrected sense, better than before, but a continued force for good, and hope to be a help in this challenging set of times. I mean, I guess I've thought, being in Chicago last weekend, I've thought that, curfew in quarantine is a rough set of circumstances. And I hope and think that we all can find a way to do better. The optimist in me sees no other path. And I hope and think that there will be a hopefully very positive outcome from all this.
One hopes.
Although I'm confident there are challenges between here and there.
Well, I'll leave it with this. Stealing all the quotes and paraphrasing all the great sayings. I hope everybody remains excellent to one another, and you should be the change you want to see in the world.